and welcome to Geek History Lesson. I am Jason the Iron Podcaster Inman. Welcome to the Mayan University, where we usually take you through one subject, one character, or one person and tell you all about them in 1 hour. And today's episode's a little bit different. Recently, last month, I moderated a panel for the excellent writer Christopher Cantwell. You might know him as he is the writer of books such as She Could Fly, the Eisner-nominated Marvel series Doctor Doom, and he recently released last week, at the time of this recording last week, Iron Man number one. Yes, he is relaunching one of my favorite Marvel characters into a new series with covers by Alex Ross. By the way, there's a new designed armor that looks amazing by Alex Ross and art by Kafu. So Christopher Cantwell did a spotlight panel at Mainframe Comic Con last month. I was lucky enough to moderate it, and we had such a great conversation about Doctor Doom and comic book writing and Iron Men's that I thought, why not just let you all hear it? So, without further ado, here is a discussion and a spotlight on comic book writer and TV writer, Christopher Cantwell.
Hello, everyone. I'm Jason Inman, and welcome to the spotlight panel on Christopher Cantwell. Now, before we bring in the excellent writer, Chris, because I know you guys are excited to talk to him about Dr. Doom, you're excited to talk to him about Halt and Catch Fire, and all the excellent things he's written, I want to remind you to don't forget to go over to mainframecomiccon.com and hit that donate button to help out the Hero Initiative. And also, at any time in the comments, feel free to ask questions. We'll bring them up on screen. You can see your name. If you don't know, I'm Jason Inman, the host of the Geek History Lesson podcast. But you did not come here to talk to me. You came here to talk to Christopher Cantwell. He is the co-creator of Halt and Catch Fire, the writer of She Could Fly, and he's Eisner nominated as the writer of Doctor Doom and the upcoming writer of Iron Man. Let's bring him in here, Mr. Christopher Cantwell.
Hey, how are you guys?
Sir. How's your Sunday morning so far?
Good. I got my math wrong on Pacific versus Eastern. I always do that where it's like, we're always the last people to do anything here on the West Coast. So it's like, what's happening? But
I did the same thing. I mean, like, but you kind of have to look at it as sort of like what privilege we have as West Coasters that we're like, hey, why isn't everything in our time frame? Come to our time zone.
Stretch like, oh, what time is it? I'm going to just mosey on over to Mainframe.
I'm really admiring your Iron Man and Doom figures behind you.
Oh, yeah.
These Marvel Legends?
This one is the... this isn't the new Legends. This is like the old retro one. And then this is the 112, the like Mezco one. Here, I'll turn on his chest. I'm going to turn on his chest. Oh, he killed Doom. I'm going to turn on his... Yeah. How does this work? Oh, yeah. See, look at this. Look at that.
Wow.
That is high quality arc reactor.
Incredible. Back in our days, people's elbows wouldn't even bend. So I appreciate that. Now toys have lights.
Their faces would rub off and you'd be like, oh, well.
Oh, man. All right. So before we dive deep into some Marvel stuff and some other things, I want to ask you, are you working on any creator-owned comic books currently?
Yeah, I actually am. Well... Yes, they're none of them have been announced yet, but there's two or three that are kind of in the hopper, one for sure, and then hopefully this week I'll get the final word on a couple others, but some stuff I'm excited about. Yeah.
Any genre hints you can give us?
Well, one may have to do with someone flying, which would be nice.
Mm-hmm.
someone flying, what else? A weird, I don't know, the stuff I do is like kind of genreless. There's one that's super dark, one that's kind of nice, and one that's in the middle. I don't know, I'll phrase it like that.
All right, good enough. Yeah. I wanted to make sure, like, because I'm a big fan of She Could Fly.
Oh, so yeah. Well, there should be some final word on if we get to wrap that story up or not, but I'm excited. We'll see. I'm hoping, fingers crossed.
Nice. All right. So I want to dive into Doctor Doom here. And I want to talk about this because, by the way, congratulations on the Eisner nomination. That's pretty
Thank
impressive.
Thank you very much. No, that was really cool. And, for Salva and I to get nominated and I don't know, I think it kind of
it caught me off guard. I had no idea. I got an email from Tom and it was like, what? So that was, I mean, and Salva was funny because I'm obviously moving on to Iron Man, and he reminded me that he did win an Eisner for Iron Man. So,
oh, all right.
I won an Eisner for that one. So
don't screw it up, buddy.
Yeah. That's basically what the message was from Salva. I was like, I'll try not to. So, yeah.
When you were given the opportunity to pitch for Dr. Doom, where did you start? Because Victor Von Doom is very complex. He's a very difficult character, but also it'd be very easy to make him one note, you know. Yeah. Does constantly have him be like, curse you, Richards, like, yeah, in every issue.
Yeah, you can. I feel like in today's time, you kind of wear that out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
The first thing that happened was Will Moss reached out, and out of the blue, I kind of had an introductory email with him months before, you know, hey, I'm Chris, I'm working with Karen Berger. You know, Karen had kind of introduced us over email, and then he reaches out to me one day. This must have been last year. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he said, we're doing an anthology series called War Scrolls for War of the Realms, and we're just showing little vignettes of what's happening with other characters in the universe that aren't heavily featured in the story of War of the Realms. Mm-hmm. Would you be interested in doing a 10-page story? And I was like, yes. And I had not written for Marvel. I was doing my own independent stuff, but you know, it was like a childhood dream come true. And he didn't even know what the character was yet. He was like, give me a couple of days. I need to make sure the character's available. I'll reach back out to you. And so I had these like several days of, wondering who was going to be,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there was no one really on my list that I would have been sad about, you know, it was,
yeah.
I think I, when he came back with Dr. Doom, I was blown away. I was like, yes. And the first thing I did is I didn't want to mess it up. Right. I think you get an opportunity like that. You don't want to mess it up. So what I did immediately was I went back and read like everything I could. I mean, I went back to the 60s. I did the arcs in the 70s, the 80s, you know, I read the Books of Doom. I read Triumph and Torment. I just went back and refreshed on everything I could mm-hmm. to figure out what the story was going to be. And there's a three panel piece of Triumph and Torment that Mike Mignola drew that I really love, where it does break out of the one note you're talking about, which is it's when Doom and Strange return for a moment to Latveria. And in one panel, a young girl child hands him a flower, and you can see like they love him. And then he takes the flower and you can see that he loves them. And that to me cracked open the character, where it wasn't just evil. I mean, that's definitely there, but right. But it was, there is a love there of a totalitarian dictator for his people. And then there's the other storyline that kind of goes in tandem with that blew my mind, which was, you know, famously he was deposed and then the rightful ruler, came in. Right. And then he was out of it for a while. And then he comes back to the Fantastic Four and he's like, help me be the head of Latveria again. And they're like, what? And he says, let me show you. And he takes them to Latveria and it's like a hellhole. It's like terrible. This guy has blown it and he's gotten more nervous and anxious. He's developed his own secret police. And in a way he's like worse than Doom ever was. And so it's this weird kind of story that is like American nation building, where the Fantastic Four are like, we're just going to put this dictator back over here and then everything will be fine. So there was a sincerity to it. Mm-hmm. I thought it was fascinating. So I started from that. And then my 10-page story was called A Rose for Victor. So I actually kind of paid homage to that.
Bring it back.
Flower. Yeah. Where a kid actually gives him a rose. He has a little bit of a different reaction, but that's,
Do you have a past creator, because you did all this research, that you think like which past Fantastic Four or Dr. Doom writer do you think like handled the character the best? Now you mentioned Triumph and Torment. So I'm going to say, do you believe that's Roger Stern?
Yeah. I mean, that book, that is by far in a way my favorite. Mm-hmm. I have a little office 5 minutes from the house because I live in a small town in California, and I keep that one on my desk next to like the Marvel Handbook and other stuff, because it's great to go back and just reference. It's so contained. It's so perfect. Again, it's a story about Doom is not trying to conquer the world. He's trying to save his mother's soul. Right. Mm-hmm. So the thing I always believe about Doom is that he can love and yet has trouble being loved. I think that if there was a flaw in the guy, obviously then the other bigger things, I think that that little source wound is important. And it's that story is so great. And also that story focuses on the magic and mysticism of Doom more than the, you know, Stanley stories of the science and technology and finger guns and time machines and all of that. I think it's amazing to talk about his intellect. And I think like the relationship between him and Richards is fascinating, right? And in the Doom book, and I'm so glad we're coming back next month, because I'm going to, it's not about Richards and Victor, but I'm going to touch on their relationship. And I think it's always interesting to kind of poke at if Richards kind of knows what he's doing. Like, I feel like if there could ever be an intellectual bully that could also deny being an intellectual bully, it could be Reed Richards.
Yeah. I'd be curious to talk about that a little bit, because I know, obviously, I assume you sort of have to coordinate your book a little bit with Dan Slott and Fantastic Four, because Victorious like showed up in your first arc, and that's a Dan Slott character. Have you, in your first arc, were they like, okay, you can't use Reed Richards until like the second or the third arc because we need him to be over here, but we'll give him to you later?
Yeah. I mean, it was the parameters of the book were Slott is running with the Fantastic Four. So if they need Doom, we need to kind of make sure he's not off doing something crazy. That said, I learned a very valuable lesson from Tom Brevoort, my editor, and he's also the editor of Fantastic Four book, is that the books, even if they're coming out in the same month, it doesn't have to be contemporaneous storylines. Sometimes that's cool, right? But like big crossover events could happen in a week, right? And then your story is happening. That arc could have already ended as you continue your story for the next year. You know, you kind of
have to deal with that too, because am I right or wrong about this? And please correct me if I'm wrong. Didn't Dr. Doom like sort of die or try to destroy New York during your run in Amazing Spider-Man?
So I was very
how much of a warning did you get on that one?
About, I was trying to protect, you know, the larger narrative of the 616 universe with the character. And I was definitely deferential to Dan, and I made sure that Victorious would be available and all of these things, because I thought it was a wonderful character that I wanted to explore more. But yeah, there was a month where in our book, there was a coup against Doom, and in Amazing Spider-Man, he was being assassinated.
Yeah.
it was by a person that, I don't want to give anything away from our book, but it's like, I think it was the nation of Simkaria, which is next door to Latveria, was somewhat involved. And it was like, cool. You know, I was like, does Nick Spencer ever like call anyone? Like, or it's like, Tom, could you told me? And he was like, I didn't know. You know, it's so funny because there's so many.
It's when they hand you the keys to Amazing Spider-Man, you can do whatever you want.
I know, they're like, it's Spider-Man, whatever. But yeah, it was a little crazy. But since then, I think I've just tried to protect what we're doing over here. And I think with Richards, what I think is interesting in books like Doom and even in upcoming Iron Man is how do you break these guys out of their comfort zone? And if you are going to reboot, you're going to do yet another number one and all of that stuff. What can you give people that's new without sacrificing what they love? Right. And so I think the character is malleable and also kind of this like statuesque kind of impenetrable legacy. Right. Which is kind of interesting. There's a duality there where Doom is Doom and you can't really mess up Doom. Mm-hmm. Otherwise it's not going to work, but because it's almost like an American Greek myth in terms of mythology, you can really change some things and reinvent some things and at least put him with some different people. So, you know, that was where I approached the book, but eventually, you know, in Doom and Iron Man, it's like, if he's going to call someone or if he's going to need to deal with somebody, it's probably going to, like, I feel like Richards is in like his Fave 5 on Verizon, you know, even if he hates him, you know, so if he dial 4 is Richards. So I feel like you got it. When relationships are that important, I think you have to at least touch on them for inflection points in the story.
Yeah. We have a question here. Whitewell Comics in the chat says, hi, Jason and Chris. Chris, how do you handle writing a hero differently than writing a villain? And which do you prefer?
Oh boy. I mean, I think with Tony, it's been, I will say, more challenging because Doom, a villain, has a larger spectrum of actions that they can take, right? I think their bag of tricks is deeper. They're not going to be so concerned with hurting someone emotionally or physically or having a lot of collateral damage, or there's less of a code there. I think that the best heroes have a code, but it's definitely a different code or a more kind of undefined code than a hero, right? Like a hero is, and unless you're going to fully dismantle a hero, they're confined by their own moral compass in terms of what they can and can't do. And that's not writerly. I feel like if you're writing the hero, them psychologically, they're boxing themselves in, which I think is interesting because you can play a lot of the frustration of what a hero can and can't do as they assess the situation, right? As they assess some sort of crisis with themselves or in the world or universe, whatever it is. With Doom, a character like that, a villain, you can have him do something unexpectedly kind, if not self-serving. You can have ulterior motives that belie a selfishness, even if it looks like they're being noble. You can have someone do something noble out of respect. You can also have them do something truly villainous, right? Either calculated or not. Mm-hmm. Like it could be an outburst of anger or a lashing out from some sort of psychological pathology, or it can be like a plan that, you know, is going to remind people how horrible they are. And so Doom, you get a pretty big, you know, palette of paints.
Mm-hmm.
Not that Tony doesn't have those. It's just, I found that I had to be more careful with the brush strokes in terms of what you're painting, right? Cause I might have an idea where it's like, and then, you know, Tony's out of control and he kills him. You know, it's like, if you're going to do that, it has to be like really well earned. And there's usually a way to, I don't know, do that. That's not the villainous way, or a way that, you know, I'm sure people have heard the term burning the character, right?
Just
burning
the character. Yeah. I've one of the best pieces of writing advice I've ever gotten is that I've always heard that if you're writing somebody you despise, is like, you need to find something about their belief system that you can really tune into. Some, like, you know, that you can feel like, oh, I understand why they're doing X, Y, Z. Mm-hmm. For you, what is that for you for Dr. Doom?
The thing for Dr. Doom for me is I try to come up with one sentence for a character, at least in the comics, especially in characters that I haven't created, where that to me is kind of a signpost.
Mm-hmm.
For Doom, it was that Doom is both Dr. Frankenstein and the monster. I think it's his own ambitions that created the monster that he is. And I think there's an awful warped reflection that he hates and yet has an ego and self-centeredness about in terms of his own abilities. I think the thing that I actually latched into about Dr. Doom most was this idea that actually came from Halt and Catch Fire, which was an early conversation I had with Lee Pace, who played Joe McMillan, which was what the line was for Joe and why I felt that Joe was compelling and why Lee felt it was compelling. And this is actually something that Lee told me in our early conversations around the first few episodes, was that Joe is not a snake oil salesman. He's a zealot. He actually believes in what he's doing. He has a sincere belief that this will be the best thing for the world. It's just early on, he didn't care who he had to run over to get there. And I think there's something very similar about Victor, where Victor is so convinced that what he's doing is right for himself, or even if it is to control the world, again, to go back to that love of his people, he's the best version of a ruler that anyone could have, if that means the entire universe, right? Whether it be becoming, you know, fighting the Beyonder and looking for those powers, or, you know, taking Galactus and trying to harvest the energy. He's doing something that he sincerely believes in, right? He's not soulless. I think that's, he's not a psychopath, right? He's not Cletus Cassidy, right? He's not he's a different person. Like, he actually has something sincere inside him. And so I think that when you sketch that out, that draws the empathy out of the character. And I think you could say a similar thing about Tony, which is that Tony often gets himself into trouble because he believes what he's doing is right. And sometimes he will run over people in order to get that done. It's just one side of the coin, you know, that's opposite from the villain side.
And that's the perfect segue to take us right into Iron Man, because yes, many people, I think there are a lot of people, my wife especially, thinks Iron Man is like the MCU's best villain.
Best villain? That's
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a point to be made. Yeah.
Yeah. She's a Cap girl. And so as soon as she saw Civil War, she's like, that's the worst villain in the MCU, Iron Man.
He can be. I think he can.
Yeah. He really can be. So I really want to ask you, because this is Iron Man is a character that has so many great runs and so many runs with different feels. Like Iron Man has so many runs that do not feel the same.
Yes.
So for you, what are some of your favorite Iron Man runs of the past, or even do you have any Iron Man runs that you're taking inspiration from?
Yeah. I mean, I think the answer to all those things is yes. I mean, I think that, you know, when I got to the opportunity to pitch on Iron Man, it was a heavy research, but also I think that came a little later, to be honest. And it's not that I was flippant about the character. It's that that character has so much legacy, mm-hmm. right? As one of these kind of vanguard characters of the Marvel universe, I had to kind of go in with a completely clear head and go, okay, what am I going to do here that is the most interesting to me? And I think that subsequently I drew a bunch of inspiration, but I had to kind of build a cornerstone of that, my version of that guy in my head first. So it was like, I had to clean slate it a little bit more than Doom. I think I wanted to come in and have something to say about him, and then try to back that up with a bunch of different inspirational materials that I'd pulled from the past. I had done some accidental research into him because I had gone deeply into Infamous Iron Man for Doom, mm-hmm. And read some of that. And, you know, I think that Fraction's run, Bendis's run are incredible. I think that what Dan has done in terms of this blending of man and machine storyline and this whole idea of AI rights is fascinating. It's like very kind of like, you know, Blade Runner-y type, futuristic, mm-hmm. heady intellectual stuff that has a lot of drama baked into it that I think is fascinating. I think I wanted, since we were going to do another number one, as I wanted a bigger pivot away from that. So even for like Fraction and Bendis, like I wanted to move away from the hyper sophisticated nanites, extremists, you know, all of that stuff. I wanted to try to do something different. I thought that story was so well cataloged and told all the way through Dan, mm-hmm. the idea of blending man and machine, that I wanted to go a different direction, and I wanted to see if there were a different direction that I could find. And for me, that was to go back to this idea of classics with him, not in a nostalgia sense, but in a, again, to go back to Halt and Catch Fire, right? You have the hyper sophisticated software programmer, right? Mm-hmm. You have the Steve Jobs of it all. You have the Steve Wozniak of it all. But even talking about Wozniak, you look at the other character, Gordon Clark and Halt. And my favorite stuff was when they were literally pulling stuff apart and they were soldering stuff and they were, you know, shocking themselves and doing all of this, you know, different stuff. That kind of heavy mechanical, close to the metal feel felt like a different shade on Iron Man, one we hadn't seen in a while. So I kind of approached it from the perspective of like a car mechanic, right? I was like, let's put him in a greasy garage. Mm-hmm. So literally in, you know, the first issue, like his new kind of home base place yeah. is like beneath his new apartment in New York is this like garage. It's literally a garage. And I wanted to feel like this guy is wearing a muscle car that is rather unwieldy, has a lot of horsepower, and can get out of control very easily. You know, I think he can break traction in that suit. And I think that it's true of Tony's mind too, right? Is he's just so kind of hyper aware, mm-hmm. and moving so quickly. He has a lot of horsepower in him too. I mean, and also in terms of the ego, like you were talking about, I mean, he gets revved up, and that's when I think Tony gets the most dangerous to himself and others. So that's where I wanted to go with it, and that felt new. And so in looking at the runs, you know, I went into, you know, the end of the first Layton, Michelinie run, And then I don't even have them. I think over here, you got like, I have, you know, Denny O'Neill's stuff, dealing with the aftermath of Demon in a Bottle, and then Armor Wars, which I think is fascinating because that's a story of Tony's paranoia. Like, that is really, you're ripping me off. Like, everybody is awesome and good only because they stole my technology and now I'm going to go destroy all of it. That's fascinating to me. Like, that's a very selfish motivation that's underneath the mask of the hero, right? And then, you know, all the way through, you know, Burn and stuff like that. Like, that kind of fillet of the Iron Man legacy was really where I'm trying to pull from, because that, I feel, was where he was most emotional, most basic and simple, and not wrapped up in
being a living computer.
A living computer, right? Because that's an amazing story, and
yeah,
taking him all the way there through Iron Man 2020. I mean, it's happening. He's been a sentient consciousness in a virtual realm. Like, you know, I don't know where you go after that. So it's like, let's try this road. Let's see what's down this road.
I love that you gave the reference to where basically if anybody needs to understand any of your comic book runs, all you need to do is go to Netflix and watch Halt and Catch Fire. So
you'll see the things I'm preoccupied with. Yeah.
We have a great question here from Jace Malam, who also hosts a great podcast called The Comic Source. Says, morning, guys. Chris, can you talk a little bit about choosing Korvac for Iron Man? By the way, real quick, I don't think we've told anybody. When does Iron Man issue one come out?
September 16th.
September 16th. All right.
And the week after Dr. Doom 7 comes out, which is nice. Great.
All right. So let's talk about Korvac.
Korvac. Okay. So I will say, even as a comic book nut, I was not fully really aware of Korvac until maybe a couple years ago. I was working on, or no, this must have been last year when I was pitching on Doom, but I was having dinner with Dinesh Samadasani, who used to run Valiant. Mm-hmm. He started a production company. So we were talking about a project that we're doing together, and he's a comic book freak. And we were talking about Galactus and Thanos, and he was like, who cares about those guys? He's like, the most powerful villain in Marvel history is Korvac. And we started talking about it, and he was telling me the story, and I went back and read the saga. And this was before Iron Man. I was like, oh my God, like,
yeah,
well, this is an incredible, the Korvac saga is like, what crazy kind of story was this that they did back then? And I was even flirting with, I was like, is there a way to get him in towards the end of the arc of Doom? Like, we got to do something with this guy. And then Al Ewing in Marvel Comics 1000 did a one-page story about Korvac being brought online by the Enclave. You could see that they built some sort of android and they have him all hooked up to cables and they're turning him on and they say Korvac is online. And so when I was trying to think of the big bad for this first arc for Iron Man, it was front of mind. It was like, I want to write something about this character. And it made so much sense to me to write a story about another guy with a God complex, which is exactly what Tony has. Even if at the beginning of our story, he's professing to try to put that God complex down, Korvac is a guy who has a God complex, especially in a way that he's going to return, because Korvac starts as kind of a weird android with like a computer table for legs, you know, that he was made into because, he comes from
the almost complete opposite of what Iron Man is, being very streamlined.
Right. Yeah. Like, and he was kind of like a dastardly level guy, but then they did this fascinating thing where he accesses the powers cosmic on, Tatu, Galactus's ship.
Mm-hmm.
And then he becomes God. I mean, like they went full bore and he was like, he's God. And that to me was amazing, to give someone unlimited power like that. So if we were going to meet him again and he was starting from scratch, there's definitely a place he wants to return to.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Which is, I remember that was pretty cool. When I was God. So I think he's got his mindset on that. I think he doesn't have any reservations or facade, right? In a way he's even more so that than Doom, right? Doom wants to be God, but I don't think he would say that out loud. You know, I think he might even think he already is, or, you know, that he doesn't need the powers cosmic, whatever it is. He's got so much pathology and baggage, but like, I feel like Michael Korvac is like, I need that. And what's also great about Korvac is also not selfish, at least in his mind. He wants to make a utopia, right? Which is where he was in the 70s. He felt bad about killing the Avengers because he was like, they're noble people. but I have to kill them in my Forest Hills house in New York, right? Like it was. So he professes to have good intentions. I think that's always fascinating in a bad guy, because Tony is someone who professes to have good intentions. So there's a neat, you know, blurring
there. Kind of opposite there. We have a great question here from Lavina Mikado, who says, "Hi, Chris. Can you talk more about the supporting characters besides Hellcat? Who will be seen in Iron Man?" And it's funny because that was a question I was going to ask you, because I actually think one of the greatest characters in the Marvel Universe is James Rhodey Rhodes. And Iron Man does have a pretty deep bench of a supporting cast. So what is your Iron Man run supporting cast going to be like?
I will say that it's... At first, it'll feel different, right? Because I think we want to... Tom had this idea that I really gravitated towards, which is to like remove Tony from his comfort zone, which I think is always fascinating when you do that with a character, especially if you're going to do a number one. It's like, what does that feel like? So there are going to be some people that populate the story early on that we haven't seen in a while. Hellcat is probably chief among them. Tony hasn't gone up against Korvac since the 70s. You know, he's moving to New York, so there he's not going to be in close proximity to the folks he's always hanging out with. But I don't want to, I'm not going to spoil anything, but the end of Iron Man 2020 is he kind of is in need of a re-examination. He's kind of like, who am I? What's going on with me? That said, to the Reed Richards point from earlier, he will have to get in contact with folks that he knows pretty well, you know, eventually. So Rhodes is a big part of things moving forward after a few issues. Rhodes comes in, and I think in an unexpected way, we see some interesting stuff with him, and then it kind of spirals from there. And I think in a cool way, because he's a great person to reflect back Tony's ego, because if there's anything about, I feel like Rhodes is a wonderful character about duty, and there's a lack of ego to that, which I think is incredible. And he's kind of Iron Man without the ego part in a way. Right. And I think that is an interesting foil to Tony, and you know, I want to bring that in because it's important to the character. Again, like a cornerstone of Tony Stark is his ego. And yeah.
Yeah. I want to ask you too, as well. You have a killer art team with this book. You have Kafu and Alex Ross on covers. And I love the new Iron Man design. I love the idea. For lack of a better descriptor, I like Iron Man armors that seem like circles, or bring the circles back. And you brought the circles back. It very seems much like the Leighton era. Was this designed completely by Alex Ross? And I want to ask, did you have any input, or did you just let Alex go his own way?
Well, when I heard, I mean, my initial pitch, I had included some stuff about the armor because it's such a incredible point for the character, right? You can't divorce the character from the armor. I think even in the last issue of Empire, or the one before last, he said something to Reed Richards like, I think in armor, or something like that. Like he's designing armor to fight, you know, the alien race in Empire. So that to me is fascinating. So I feel like if you're going to have a guy trying to turn over a new leaf, I mean, that should be reflected in what he's doing with his armor. And for me, if this story was going to be more about the nuts and bolts and the humanity and the greasy garage mechanic aspects of Iron Man, my big thing in my pitch, which is probably the only piece of input I really had in the character, was I wanted to see his eyes again in the helmet. I wanted to see his eyes again. And again, to your point of the living computer, I wanted to see Tony's eyes, cause I think that that's fascinating. You know, we're not going to go so far as to, you know, when the mask used to emote in the 70s and 80s, where you would get mad.
Like the Spider-Man eyes. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, but even though like, that's cool. Like that's what's kind of amazing about comic books is you kind of go with that stuff.
Did you ever fight where you're like, Alex, we've got to see the nose. Like, remember that one armor?
We're not seeing the nose. I really just said, I want to see his eyes. And I want to feel, I think Tom and I talked about this, like I want it to feel like pieces that he puts on. And there's the famous Leighton Romita cover, right? Where he's literally strapping it on. And we, you know, Kafu did that in the first issue. right? Like that he puts the armor on and you see him pushing buttons so that it connects to the thigh and the boot and the, you know, and he carries it in the briefcase like he used to do, which I'm
very in the briefcase back.
Oh yeah. No, he opens up the briefcase and it's in the briefcase.
In your mind, as the official writer of Iron Man, I've always wanted to ask an Iron Man writer this: how heavy is that briefcase? Because logically, that briefcase should be like 500 pounds.
Doesn't make any sense. Well, I mean, that's the thing, right? I always think of the scene in Iron Man 1 when he tests out the armor,
yeah,
and then he turns it off, and he's like a foot and a half from the floor, and he goes through the floor of the garage because the armor is so. That insinuates that it's incredibly heavy.
Yeah.
I again doing my the nerdy research
on this guy has got oh boy.
I read that Tony weighs something like 225, I guess, because he's 6 feet and strong, and that with the armor he weighs anywhere from 425 to 625, so that's like 200 to 400 pounds of armor on his body.
Yeah,
and then he can keep it in a briefcase. This is get into the minutiae of this, but like. I think I kind of try to touch on the fact that he relies on a lot of internal systems to help move that are wed to his actual physiology. And that if it's completely dead weight, I think that that's probably a problem for him.
Yeah.
That's something I was reading in some of the older runs too. It's like when the thing turns off, it's like, I can't do it. You know, that to me is fascinating. The briefcase, I don't know.
Like, well, that's why we do panels like this, man, is to get in on that.
Yeah. We have a question here. He took his helmet off and stuff in this. So, but then Alex and Kafu just went and like built something incredible. When I saw it, I was like, I mean, it's gorgeous.
No, it's great design. Ubermall has a question here, taking us down a different track. Hey guys, big Halt and Catch Fire fan. What a special show. Chris, did you end up keeping anything from the set? Like, is the Cardiff Electric Giant in your basement or something? All right. So yes, let the lawyers know what you stole of their property.
Yes, I did. I mean, at that point, like, that stuff goes into storage.
Oh, I know, but
come get me, AMC.
Yeah, it's like, I think Jerry Seinfeld kept the Superman.
Did he?
Yeah,
that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we all pilfered the set. I had the mutiny sign that John Bosworth had in his office in season 3. He had a sign from Mutiny with the logo, and it was all signed by the coders. And the idea behind that, it was never a story point, was that when he was going to stay in Texas and they were all going to go to California without him, they all made a goodbye thing for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he ended up going with them. So he brought it with, and it's in his office still. And like Mackenzie actually signed it as Cameron, and Carrie signed it as Donna. And I had it, I kind of took it, or maybe I think someone sent it to me from the set, and I had the thing, and all the coders actually signed it. And I didn't have anywhere to put it. I wasn't going to put it up my house. I mean, it's cool, but I don't have a big house, and my wife would be like, okay, like I don't even put a shrine to you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, okay. And so I had it, and I kept it in my garage. And during the pandemic, there was that really wonderful auction thing that Sam Humphries put together with a couple other folks. And I auctioned it off, and someone who's a huge fan of the show got it and was very happy and, you know, fixed it up. And
what was the shipping like on that?
The what?
What was the shipping like on that?
It was intense, but you know, it's for a good cause, but yeah, it was a lot. The only other thing I kept really was I kept Gordon's original Altair 8800, which we got off of eBay, and it's, you know, it's a real one. I think it's functioning, but again, it's in my garage. It's on top of, I build a lot of small models and crafts and stuff. So it's in my garage, but it's an original Altair 8800, which is crazy. It's from Gordon's house or apartment in the 70s where he lived with Donna.
That's nice. That's nice. We have a great comment here. Evening says, Halt and Catch Fire was close to perfection. Feel lucky now that it got to finish properly after so many good shows getting binned after season 2 these days.
Yeah,
I know. I think we can tell Evening is from across the pond. Hello, United Kingdom, because you said bend.
Yeah, bend. yeah, you know, it's a bummer that they're doing that now where they kind of just trash it after 2 seasons because they've got the content. I know that happened to Mindhunter, and
yeah,
that's a heartbreaker because I thought season 1 was brilliant. Season 2 was really heavy, but I also thought incredible.
So since you're connected to like what I would call a fan favorite series, is a luminary series, what's a lesson since you got to complete your story, you got to complete your show in your terms, basically, What's a lesson that you're taking into your next show? Like, what is the halt and catch fire lesson that you learned that you're taking into your next show? Which, I know you are working on another show. You have been announced as working on another show. We're not going to ask you any questions about it, but can we say it on here?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It's
the amazing Paper Girls. Yeah, man. That's awesome.
Yes. It's very cool.
You're the co-showrunner of that, correct?
Yes. With Chris Rogers, who I created Halt with, mm-hmm. and then Seth Folsom, who sold the original pitch of the series with Brian. Yeah, and she wrote Toy Story 4, co-wrote it, and co-wrote Thor 3, and comes out of that incredible wonderland. I feel very fortunate to be on that with Chris. I think it's interesting because, you know, we came on after the fact because they decided they needed, you know, showrunners with seasons of television under their belt. I think it made sense for us because we had written some really, you know, in my opinion at least, solid, good female lead characters of our show, that I'm still very proud of. And you know, it's Steph sold this pitch, but the three of us are coming in, and I know that Chris is in my fingerprints will be on it, and that'll be great creatively. But you know, we had a showrunner come in on the first two seasons of Halt, a guy named Jonathan Lisko, and we couldn't have asked for a better mentor or person to teach us the ropes. And it's not really that we're doing that with Steph, because I think she could do all this herself, but mm-hmm. we're coming in with television experience, and the best thing we can do is impart that on somebody else and also say, like, what is the best version of this show? Let's make sure that happens and not let any ego or anything like that get in the way. You know, I think I just coincidentally happened to have a nascent comic background when that thing materialized. You know, it was a series that Chris Rogers had happened to read. He's not as big of a comic book person as I am, but he knew of it. I think just because it's one of those series that transcends its medium in terms of, you know, it being known out there. So it's a very exciting show. I again, it's a female ensemble. You know, we are the only two, you know, white guys in the room. That was important to us.
Nice.
The Supergirls are a very diverse cast. They come from all walks of life, so we really tried to flesh that out with the right writers' room. And you know, it's a show told from a female perspective. So Steph is there, and we have a lot of female writers bringing their experience and female producers and things like that. That's very important. I'm not going to walk into the Paper Girls room and be like, here's what I think you should do when you're 12 and a woman, you know, like it's not what I'm,
I have all this experience.
I'm there to write stuff on the board. Like, good idea. You know, like I think that show is being made by such a great group. I think Chris and I always run a very friendly room.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of best ideas wins room. No one has a title when they walk in the room. You just do it. And you break it down to the beats of the scene, man. And like, that's how we did it on Halt. And that just works for us. So we're doing that on Paper Girls. Yeah.
Nice. Well, I want to ask you real quick, just because, you know, I love asking these questions to television writers and working in television myself. What do you prefer as your writer room hours? Where do you guys find, what's your peak productivity time for the rooms you run?
I think we're very humane in our hours. I think that obviously when we were meeting in person, which is not happening anymore now, you know, we wouldn't get started until 10:30, 11. I also live outside of LA, so I take the train in, and then the subway. So I'm doing that. And then like an assistant's picking me up and going like, hopefully 4 minutes away. So we're starting around 10:30, 11, depending on what conversations the showrunners have to have before you get in the room. And it's a law of diminishing returns. I mean, you go past 5.
Oh yeah. So you're done.
Like, I want to die. Like, no, nothing good is, I'm not thinking of anything good. You know, I'm like, I want to see my sons for dinner. I like to go watch some TV with my wife, you know, like staying all hours of the night is until we get this. That's all about the person running the show, in my opinion, and it has nothing to do with the content of the show. Sometimes there's very few days where it's like, we just need to get this fully carded up on the board where we all know the beats. We just want to interrogate them enough and get it up so we can say, episode 5 is broken. You go write the outline. Let's go. Right. But even then it's like, oh man, 6:15, you know, like that's, we don't go crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. We have a couple of great questions here that we're going to take to wrap up here. Bilal Elian, I hope I said your name correctly. I just read reading I just read Kaminsky's run on Iron Man, and I found it fascinating how Tony tried to run Stark Enterprises. Many times it felt like a legal drama. Will we see more of Tony the businessman?
Well, first, if someone can find me on Twitter and point me to a place where I can get Kaminsky's run in hardcover, that would be great, because it is one I've read pieces of it, but I want to just like get it all at once, because it's like this fascinating, like Dark Horse run of not Dark Horse comics, but Dark Horse run of Iron Man that I really want to get my hands on. Cause I think he did something really fascinating with the character. Tony as a businessman. I mean, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't think so. You've been on interviews back to basics and garage. I was like,
it's kind of just the dude, you know what I mean? He's like, he's separating himself even more so from Stark Unlimited at the beginning of the first issue, just because I wanted to just pull him all the way into just the guy in the suit. So he's not batting it around with Dr. Shapiro and all these crazy people. Mm-hmm.
Last question here we'll take is from White Whale Comics. How has production differed from an original project like Halt and Catch Fire and an adapted project like Paper Girls? And how much did you try to keep the look of the comic in the show? I guess a great little follow-up on that is how much is Brian K. Vaughan involved in the current production?
I mean, the long and short of it is Brian is involved as much as he wants to be, because he's a genius. He's also one of the nicest people I've met. He's been very supportive of us. He knows that the story has to change, because the original comic book only that takes place over 2 days, even though there are so many issues of the comic book. I think it's a 48-hour story. Well, ours aren't going to, it's not going to be that for TV, right? Because actors age and all this stuff. So it's very different. Brian, you know, Brian reads everything that we generate. He comes into the room when we really want to just pick his brain. Cliff is another important part of the show. We haven't gotten to Cliff yet. Just because, you know, we're still in the writing phase. We're still putting this thing together. And the most important thing that's happening is on the page. So when that's right, obviously you start to build everything else. Cliff, I'm sure, will be integral to those conversations. Both him and Brian are executive producers on the show. Mm-hmm. I think that is important. You know, those are decisions that are not made by me. They're made by Amazon and Legendary, but I'm very happy that that's the level of clout they both have, because they created this incredibly original thing. Halt and Catch Fire, you know, the showrunners have a lot of input and the creators have a lot of input on what the look's going to be. But then you're really having a lot of conversations with the production designer. You're having conversations with the pilot director, which is always a very important choice when you're starting the show, is who's the pilot director going to be, you know, and that person comes in and they bring a very cinematic eye to what you're talking about for your story. And we had Juan Campanella, who had won an Oscar for his film Secret in Their Eyes, and he came in and really helped establish the look of Halt and Catch Fire. Mm-hmm. A lot of the look of the show is owed to Juan. So even as a director moves on and other directors come in, they're adhering to the look of the show. And the DP, right, the director of photography, is the one who is kind of the gatekeeper of the show's look. So if a director comes in and is like, I want to do a crash zoom onto Joe McMillan, the DP's like, we don't do that on this show. And the DP needs to be empowered enough to do that. Now, sometimes a director will be like, well, I want to do a crash zoom. And then you do a crash zoom and then you have to figure out how to cut around it. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And some people are like, why did you do a crash zoom in that episode? And it'd be like, well, because this asshole came in and directed the show and not coming back, you know, like that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Christopher, this was an awesome conversation. Thank you so much for coming here. Please let all the people watching now and in the future, long into the future, what some of the books they can pick up. Like, please remind us when Iron Man 1 is coming out and where they can find you on social media.
Yes. So Iron Man number 1 comes out September 16th. Very excited. Dr. Doom returns the week after. I don't have the date in my head, but just add 7, I guess, to 16. I guess it'll be the 23rd.
There you go.
Dr. Doom comes back. My book, Everything, which was my second Burger Books book, its second arc got pushed way back because of the pandemic. But it is coming out straight to trade early next year. And that is the conclusion of that story. And I think it's great sci-fi fun that's coming back with that. And yeah, and then hopefully I'll have some announcements, you know, over the next few months, you know, online. You can find me online at if you can't well on Twitter.com, I believe is what it's called.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me on a Sunday morning about Iron Man and all kinds of stuff. Everyone out there, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Jawin, J-A-W-I-I-N. And you can find my podcast, Geek History Lesson, all over where you can listen to podcasts. You know, you can put podcasts in your holes. I got to have Chris on here to talk about Dr. Doom or Iron Man soon.
That would be a lot of fun. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've got a podcast coming out, actually.
Oh, please talk about it.
This is brand new, and we haven't really talked about it. A podcast coming out with my wife, who is a poet and a crazy PhD doctor, and it's called Spores, Molds, and Fungus, if anybody gets that reference. But it's all about obsessive topics. It's what we're obsessing about that week, and it's, you know, it's some fun married banter, but you got to do something while you're doing a pandemic.
I love how you called a person with a PhD the crazy one.
Yeah, he kind of is. Wait till you hear the podcast. It's pretty fun. Spores, Molds, and Fungus, which I think will be out in a couple weeks. We've got a couple episodes banked.
Awesome. Looking forward to that. Everyone watching, thank you so much for watching. Also, don't forget to go to mainframecomiccon.com and consider hitting that big old donate button and giving to the Hero Initiative. It really makes a difference because that's what made the show free. Chris, thanks again for joining us. Everyone out there, thank you for joining us. I'm Jason Inman, and that's it for this panel. Goodbye.